Today on Against the Grain. We're living through the sixth great extinction of species, and governments are doing almost nothing to curb it. Scientist Douglas Tallamy, however, proposes a blueprint for a grassroots effort to restore habitat in a meaningful way, seeing nature not as something to be preserved in parks and reserves far from us, but all around us, in our cities and suburbs, farmlands and ranches. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The decline of species in the last half century is astounding, and it's accelerating. Insects, plants, amphibians, all are shrinking in numbers. A third of birds in North America are now gone, as are a third of invertebrates, much of it driven by habitat loss. It seems like an impossible and thoroughly disheartening situation. However, Douglas Tallamy argues that those of us who live in apartments and houses can collectively make a difference by restoring the habitats around us. Tallamy is professor in the Department of Entomology and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Delaware and the author of Nature's Best Hope, A New Approach to Conservation That Starts in Your Yard. When I spoke with Douglas Tallamy, I asked him to explain how the notion of wilderness and the preservation of wild spaces has changed over time.
We really don't have any true wilderness anymore. Humans have impacted every corner of the earth, either directly or now, certainly indirectly with climate change. But I mean, there's microplastics everywhere. There's pesticides everywhere. So true wilderness, the absence of humans and their effect, doesn't really exist. But that doesn't mean we can't have wildness. We can't have nature operating pretty much unimpeded. And I think that's what a lot of people look for when they talk about wilderness.
I wonder if you could tell us about the way that preservation has changed somewhat since the early 20th century, given what you've just said, the transformation of wild places. Initially, there was an attempt to preserve wild places. At what point was that clear that that was not going to be effective enough and that ecosystems were suffering, habitats were still diminishing, and species were shrinking?
You know, our national park system was initiated primarily to preserve exquisitely beautiful places. Teddy Roosevelt had a lot to do with that, and he said this is a sign of good administration, and it's a sign that we value our national beauty, and it's a wonderful place to recreate in. And those were the motivations. It really wasn't conservation. We didn't think too much about conservation then, and that's why only 3.6% of the U.S. is in national parks, and only 12% is federally protected. Which leaves 88% without any long-lasting protection. So we have learned, ecologists have learned over the years, that when you take a large habitat and you shrink it down to a small habitat, you're taking large populations and shrinking them down to small or tiny populations. And that is the major problem of these isolated preserves. The populations within them are small. Now, all populations fluctuate. So in good times, they go up. In bad times, they go down. If you're a large population, even in your downside, you can recover quickly because there's enough individuals left. But if you're a tiny population, often in the down cycles, there's too few to recover, or they actually disappear altogether. They blink out of their little habitat patch. So our parks and preserves are bleeding species readily. And of course, in between parks and preserves, which are all isolated from each other, that's no man's land. We haven't designed it for biodiversity to be able to survive in those spaces. So that's been the major problem, is that we haven't preserved enough connected spaces so that the populations within them can be stable, even in their down cycles.
Can you give us a sense of the degree to which the biodiversity crisis has intensified? You know, what are the markers of this crisis?
Well, we're actually starting to measure things like that. We've got global insect decline. Some very long-term studies have shown that insects have declined dramatically, particularly in the temperate zone. A recent study came out measuring bird declines in North America. 3 billion breeding birds are gone now, which is a third of our North American bird population already gone. A study in 2014 says we've lost 45% of our invertebrates so far. Plants are in trouble. The UN is predicting we're going to lose 1 million species to extinction in the next 20 years. It's really dismal news. And it is saying that we are now in the sixth great extinction event that the planet has ever experienced. So I'm just listing a few of the ills. Our amphibians, for example, I don't know what the figure is, 45% or something, either gone or in serious decline. So biodiversity is declining just about everywhere, which certainly makes sense. We are expanding our human footprint everywhere. The Earth and its resources is finite. The more we take, the more the less is left for anything else. So we're dividing up the pie in a not very fair way. So we've left very little for the natural world.
And what is the importance of habitat loss in that extinction crisis and the shrinking numbers of animals and plants?
Well, the biggest problem is that we've had this idea that humans and nature cannot coexist. Humans are here and nature someplace else. So whatever we develop for human use, we have not developed with the idea of maintaining functional ecosystems. It's not that we can't. It's just that it has not been a priority. We've developed our landscapes for aesthetics only, not for ecological function, which means wherever we go, there's habitat loss. And when there's habitat loss, you're shrinking the viable habitats that are left into tinier and tinier spaces. And as we said earlier, those tiny populations are not enough to maintain themselves. So what I've been promoting for the last 20 years is to reverse that, to learn how to coexist with nature, where we live, where we work, where we farm, where we play. And there's many ways we can do that so that the spaces in between those isolated habitats are not no man's land anymore. They're actually viable habitat, even though humans are there.
Talk a bit more about that. What is the importance of having habitats connected to each other? Why is that so vital?
Well, isolated habitats can suffer from inbreeding. You have related individuals breeding with each other over and over, and that can lead to inbreeding depression, which leads to all kinds of problems. So the concept of biological carters has been promoted where we build corridors where the plants and animals can move back and forth between these habitats. The problem with that is that's to promote genetic exchange, but it doesn't increase the population sizes. There's still tiny populations within these little habitats. So I want to go beyond biological carters and build viable habitats every place we can. That's going to be harder to do in the middle of a city, but not impossible. But, you know, suburbs, actually, there's a lot of possibilities in suburbs and even more in rural areas. We tend to think that our farmland can't house biodiversity. That is nonsense. You know, the biggest monarch population that was ever recorded was 1976 in the Midwest. And there certainly was a lot of agriculture in the Midwest. So we just have to put the habitat back along the sides of the roads of the agriculture. We have to stop poisoning them unnecessarily with neonicotinoids. There's a lot of things that we can do that won't decrease farm yield at all, and we can rebuild biodiversity over huge portions of the country.
Well, thinking about that, what the elements of a restored ecosystem might look like, starting with trees and plants, can you tell us where most of the trees in our cities and the plants in our gardens come from?
They come from someplace else. It's another continent. So it depends on where you live. In the northern areas, it's almost always Asia. Some from Europe. Down in Florida and along the Gulf Coast, an awful lot of plants are from South America. But we value the unusual. So the horticulture trade has pushed plants from other continents for the last century. If you decide that a plant is only a decoration, you want to get the prettiest plant. And you want to get a plant that nothing else will touch. Nothing can eat it. So you're looking for plants that are essentially, they're pretty, but they're not part of the local ecosystem. They're not contributing energy to the local ecosystem by having something actually eat part of them. And we have decorated our landscapes from coast to coast with these types of ornamental plants. What's worse is many of these have escaped our plantings and become serious invasive species. 85% of our woody invasive plants in this country are escapees from our garden. So not only have we transformed the first trophic level, that plant community that harnesses energy from the sun and turns it into food and then passes it on, we've transformed that from native plants to non-native plants where we live. And then so many of those plants have escaped into our natural areas. So in so many natural areas, up to a third of the vegetation is non-native. And that has devastated local food webs.
And we'll return to the question of native plants. But I wanted to ask you about the centrality of insects. Why are insects so crucial for the health of the larger ecosystem, including us?
Well, E.O. Wilson, Edward O. Wilson, way back in 1987, laid that out very clearly for us. He said, life as we know it depends on insects. If they were to disappear, so would most of our pollinators. And that means 90% of our flowering plants would also disappear. That would so drastically change energy flow through our terrestrial ecosystems that the food webs that support our vertebrate animals, our amphibians, our reptiles, our birds, and our mammals, those food webs would collapse and all those animals would disappear. He said the earth would rot because we would have lost insect decomposers that rapidly turn over nutrients and all we would have is bacteria and fungi. And he reminded us that humans wouldn't survive any of those very drastic changes. So it's something we need to think about. We need insects. We depend on them. Yet we've had this cultural war against them forever. So that's something that's got to change.
Well, you were listing off the extent of the biodiversity crisis. It is often said that there's a great abundance of insects in contrast to other species. To what degree are insects also under duress from the larger crisis that ecosystems are facing?
To a great extent. We've got this by the talk about the insect apocalypse is here. Dave Wagner at the University of Connecticut likens insect losses. People always want to know what's hurting them. Well, he says it's death by a thousand cuts. Everything's hurting them. We have industrial agriculture where we misuse and abuse insecticides. We have 44 million acres of lawn out there, which it's an ecologically dead landscape. It doesn't support insects or anything else. 82% in a typical neighborhood, 82% of the plants that we decorate our landscapes with are from other countries, and they're not supporting our insects. We have light pollution. It's a major cause of insect decline everywhere. There's lights on all the time. Our mosquito fogging now. And the mosquito foggers say, well, it only kills mosquitoes. That's not at all true. It kills all the insects it comes in contact with, including the poor beleaguered monarch, including all those pollinators we're trying to save. So we are killing insects pretty much everywhere. Climate change, a huge one. You know, when you have a forest fire, you kill all the insects that are there. When you have a flood, it's very hard on them. When you have a terrible drought, it kills the plants that the insects need. So insect decline in the West is very serious. I could go on, but it gets pretty depressing.
Douglas Tallamy is my guest. He is professor in the Department of Entomology and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Delaware. We're discussing Nature's Best Hope, a new approach to conservation that starts in your yard. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, you were just talking about the vital importance of insects, and I wondered if you could tell us about the role that caterpillars in particular play, why they're so important.
Way back in 1988, Dan Janssen, a very famous ecologist, wrote in a paper that insects are the bread and butter of terrestrial ecosystems. They are the bread and butter, the hamburger and french fries. He had a lot of analogies, but what he means is they are transferring more energy from plants to other animals than any other type of plant eater. In other words, a lot of things eat caterpillars, Very few vertebrates actually eat plants directly. Most vertebrates eat insects that ate plants, and most of those insects are caterpillars. So that makes them extremely important. When we decorate our yards, for example, with crepe myrtle, beautiful plant, beautiful small tree throughout the South. Well, it doesn't support any caterpillars. So if you're a chickadee and you want to feed your babies, you're not going to get any food from that plant. And what people don't appreciate is how many caterpillars it takes to make one clutch of nestlings. We'll go back to chickadees because there's a lot of data on them, but it's 6,000 to 9,000 caterpillars to get one clutch of chickadees to the point where they leave the nest. And after they leave the nest, the parents continue to feed them caterpillars for another 21 days. And after they're independent from the parents, they continue to eat caterpillars. They don't eat seeds until the winter time. That's one bird. 96% of our terrestrial birds rear their young on insects, and most of those insects are caterpillars. So if you simply look at birds, caterpillars become essential. There's a box turtle, the ornate box turtle in the Midwest. It used to be very common. It's a great caterpillar eater. They used to chase around army worm and cutworm populations and eat hundreds a day. So, you know, caterpillars are soft, they're easy to digest, they're full of protein and fats, and they're also the best source of carotenoids for animals, particularly during the breeding season when carotenoids are not available in other sources. And I'll remind you that carotenoids are essential components of vertebrate diets. We cannot make them, only plants make them. So caterpillars are doing an awful lot of animals, an awful lot of the biodiversity and higher trophic levels, a great service by taking the nutrition from plants and passing it on.
Why is it that insects seem to only eat very specific plants? You mentioned that there are all sorts of lovely decorative plants that we plant that in effect are useless for crucial insects, caterpillars among them, and therefore actually sort of starve a whole ecosystem of its food sources. I think a lot of people assume that if they have plants in their garden, insects are going to come and eat them, and one plant might be just as good as another. Why is that not the case?
Well, it's an excellent question. It's not the case because most insects are what we call host plant specialists. 90% of the insects that eat plants can only eat particular plants. And the easiest way to look at this is to visualize what monarchs do. Monarchs, of course, can only develop on milkweeds. That's host plant specialization. Now, milkweeds are toxic plants. All plants are defending themselves. They don't want to be eaten. So they load their tissues with nasty tasting chemicals, or, you know, some plants have spines and trichomes and very tough leaves. They use lots of ways to keep insects off of them, but primarily those chemical defenses. And it's a really effective type of defense that keeps most of the insects of the world from eating most of the plants of the world. And the only insects that can eat a particular plant are the ones that have evolved very specialized adaptations to get around those chemical defenses. So milkweeds are toxic plants. They're loaded with cardiac glycosides. They have sticky latex sap that gums up insect mouth parts. But monarchs can eat them because they've got the physiological adaptations to get around those cardiac glycosides. They've got enzymes that store and excrete and detoxify those compounds. They've got behavioral adaptations that can block the flow of the sticky latex sap. So they've evolved the specialization necessary to beat milkweed at its own game. The milkweed still is inedible to most insects, but monarchs have figured out how to do it. And the interesting thing is they're not special. 90% of the insects that eat plants have specialized adaptations to eat particular plants, just like the monarch. So if we bring in plants from other continents, our insects have never seen them before. They don't have those adaptations, and they're unable to eat them. It's that simple. Now, a lot of people say, well, insects adapt really quickly. They can evolve them very quickly. There's a lot of reasons why that doesn't happen. Phragmites, for example, the common reed, has been in this country for 400 years. It's a genotype from Europe. In Europe, it supports 175 species of insects. Even after 400 years here, it only supports 5 species. And it supported those 5 species on day one. They were pre-adapted. They could use Phragmites right away. So adaptation does happen. But when you're talking about host plant switches, It's very, very slow. Monarchs have specialized on milkweeds for millions and millions and millions of years. To expect them to start eating hostas or crepe myrtle or some of the other things we put in our yards practically overnight is like asking humans to evolve wings. It's just not going to happen.
So you've been painting a pretty bleak picture here of ecosystems in distress, plants that have been here for a long time but come from elsewhere, and a landscape that is just not amenable to the health of insects and all the species that are dependent on them. So while we'll get into it in more depth, I wonder if you could sum up what you think should be done about the situation. How could this be countered using our own yards and other green space to try and push back against what seems like an overwhelming deluge of disaster?
This is actually good news because it's fairly easy to turn this around. Nature is extraordinarily resilient, and it starts with those plants. If we choose the right plants and put them back into our landscapes, nature rebuilds itself. And I've got lots of examples of how that has happened, starting with my own home right here in Oxford, Pennsylvania. Our typical residential landscapes, again, are mostly lawn with a very few scattering of plants from Asia. That's not a viable habitat. So I am suggesting that we cut the area of lawn in half. So we've got 44 million acres of lawn right now. We cut that in half, that gives us 22 million acres. By the way, 44 million acres of lawn is bigger than the entire area of New England. So let's say we got 22 million acres of land that we can restore right at home simply by shrinking the lawn and then putting the very powerful plants back. I always talk about plants being in three categories. They're plants that contribute energy to local food webs, plants that don't contribute energy to local food webs, and plants that actively remove energy from local food webs. So oaks, for example, the very best contributor across the country in 84% of the counties in which they occur. If we focus on oaks and then you know, native prunus and willows and birches and hickories, there's all kinds of very powerful trees out there, depending on where you live. Herbaceous plants include goldenrods and native sunflowers, asters, evening primroses, a whole list of them that support lots and lots of biodiversity. If we were to re-landscape, focusing on what we call them keystone plants, because they are supporting most of the caterpillars that drive that food web, we can rebuild the biodiversity. And I'll give you one simple statistic. Our yard was mowed for hay. We got a piece of a farm that was broken up, and they had mowed it for hay before we moved in. There was very little there. By the time we moved in, it was loaded with invasive species. So the first thing we had to do was remove them. But we put the plants back gradually over the years, and I've been measuring the number of species of caterpillars that now make a living at our house on our property, and I'm up to 1,259 species that have come back because we put their host plants back. And it didn't take that long. It wasn't that hard. So if we can do it, if everybody put the plants back, we could turn a lot of these terrible statistics around. We really could.
Well, tell us more about the oaks, just as an example of the way a keystone species works, how an oak tree would help, and in fact, how more than one oak tree, because what you're saying is it's really not enough just to say, well, I'm going to stick a milkweed in here and maybe put a couple other native species, that there actually has to be some kind of grouping of species to make really a difference.
Right. Let's think about what each property needs to accomplish ecologically if we're going to reach a sustainable relationship with Mother Nature, with the nature that supports us. Every landscape has to support pollinators. We talk about because they pollinate a third of our crops. It's really about a 12th of our crops. I don't like the crop argument because I hear people say, I don't live next to a farm, so I don't need any pollinators. Believe me, pollinators are more than about human agriculture. They're pollinating 80% of all plants and 90% of all flowering plants. So every single landscape that's out there needs to support pollinators. Every landscape has to manage the watershed in which it lies. Every landscape has to sequester carbon, capture carbon, pull that carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, build plant tissues out of that carbon, and then pump the extra carbon into the soil for long-term storage. And finally, every landscape has to support the food web that supports all the animals around us. So you asked about oaks. Oaks do that better than all other plants combined. They're supporting, in the mid-Atlantic states where I live, they support 557 species of caterpillars. And if you compare that to a tulip tree, for example, it's another good native plant, it only supports 21 species. So there's huge differences among our native plants. That's why we focus on those keystones, those really important ones. Oaks are big trees. They're sequestering a lot of carbon. They've got huge root systems, so they're stabilizing the watershed. You know, oaks are wind pollinated, but pollinators use the pollen from oak catkins, even though they're not actually pollinating the oaks. So it actually supplies pollen for pollinators. But their biggest contribution, in my view, is their role in supporting the food web. They're making, you know, they're supporting lots and lots of species, but they're also making hundreds of them. So when that chickadee is looking for all those caterpillars in your yard, it's going to go to the oak first. Birders know if you're looking for warblers during migration, they're in the oak tree because that's where those caterpillars are. So it's outside, its contributions to local biodiversity are outsized compared to many other native plants.
Now, of course, some people might say, well, I don't have a very big yard. You know, I don't know if I can fit an oak in. And in fact, you make the argument that we would do better to plant more than just one. Perhaps you could spell that out, why quantity actually makes a difference here, and then what you would recommend for those who have limited space.
Well, keep in mind, you're not the only person doing this. So you might have a tiny property, but you're connected to another tiny property. It's connected to another tiny property. The object is to change the culture of landscaping so that everybody's contributing. If you only have room for one tree, I understand that, but your neighbor has room for one tree too, and you can build a population of productive trees in an entire neighborhood without too much trouble. If you really have a very small property, there are actually dwarf oaks. Dwarf chinkapin oak, Quercus prinoides is a good example, makes acorns when it's 5 feet tall. And if you live in an apartment, you can use container gardening. Doesn't have to be an oak tree. That's just the best. But there are all kinds of native plants that do well in containers that would help pollinators, help those migrating monarchs. Everybody can contribute. But there is no doubt that if you own a piece of property, you have more options than the apartment dweller does.
And you're also arguing that some plants are also keystone plants or have more of an impact than others, that while you're exhorting us all to plant native plants, that some will be more helpful than others. Can you give us a sense of why that is and which plants are standout plants?
Well, it is because they are supporting more caterpillars. They're supporting more specialist pollinators. A third of our 4,000 species of native bees can only reproduce on the pollen of particular plants. So the plants that support the specialist are more important because the generalist can use those plants as well. So they're simply more productive. Why are they more productive? Well, why are oaks supporting, you know, over the country 950 species of caterpillars? There's a number of hypotheses. It's an old genus, so they've been around a long time. A lot of things have adapted to them. It's a large genus. There's 91 species of oaks in North America. It's a very persistent plant. So a single oak tree can live hundreds of years compared to a spring beauty, little flower, which only lives 2 weeks. So there's a lot of we'll call it plant apparency, a lot of opportunity for insects to adapt to it. They also protect their tissues with tannins. And apparently it's easier for insects to adapt to tannins than to many other types of plant defenses. So some of these plants, these keystone plants, are passing on more of the energy they harness from the sun than other plants. And that's what makes them so important in our landscapes. I could design a 100% native landscape that supports almost nothing because we've got a lot of native plants that are really well protected and they're not sharing their energy very well. So it's not a native versus non-native. It's a productivity versus not productivity argument.
Douglas Tallamy is my guest. He's professor of entomology and wildlife ecology at the University of Delaware. We're discussing nature's best hope, a new approach to conservation that starts in your yard. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, one of the things that you encourage us to do is to plant goldenrod and ragweed, which are plants that are blamed for seasonal allergies. Why should we increase their abundance?
I do promote goldenrod. I don't promote ragweed. Goldenrod does not make us sneeze at all. It has very heavy, sticky pollen. We blame goldenrod on what ragweed does. Ragweed has very light pollen. That's what people are allergic to. Now, ragweed does support a lot of insects, but having spent the first 20 years of my life sneezing my head off, I get it that we don't have to put ragweed in our yards. But goldenrod is you know, it's totally benign in terms of impact on allergies. So, and it's such a very important plant that let's focus on that.
One of the things that you touch on in your book is that there are a lot of cultural reasons why we do what we do with our yards if we have a yard. And there are all sorts of signifiers that, you know, a lawn serves as, or certain flowers, plants serve as. And there are habits, practices that people engage in that often is just people do it because they think that's what one should do. One of them is raking leaves. And of course, a lot of that is connected to having a lawn, raking leaves to get it off the lawn. Can you tell us why you think raking and removing one's leaves is not a great idea?
Sure. Well, let's look at what leaves do for us. They fall from the tree, and of course, they're containing all the nutrients that tree used that year. You've got to get those nutrients back into the soil so that the tree can use them again. So leaves that fall to the ground are a mechanism to getting nutrients recharged in the soil. They also form a blanket over the soil, which protects the moisture in the soil, the humidity. There are more species that live in the soil than above the soil, and all of them require high levels of humidity, of moisture. And that includes the mycorrhizal fungi that transfer nutrients from the soil to our plant roots, very important communities in the soil. So leaves are transferring nutrients. They're also protecting the health of the soil community. They're preventing erosion. They're preventing the sun from baking and drying out the soil. They also are the homes of a lot of very important critters. You know, people say, well, how come I don't see lightning bugs the way I used to see fireflies? Well, they're predators in leaf litter. And when we rake all the leaves away, of course, you're throwing away the habitat that our fireflies require. There are 70 species of moths that we call litter moths, where the caterpillars develop on dead leaves on the ground. There are beautiful butterflies that develop on dead leaves on the ground. So it's a living community, and we tend to rake it up and throw it away. And you're right, it's directly connected to the lawn. My son bought a house a few years ago, and the first fall he called me up and he said, Dad, I've got too many leaves. What should I do with my leaves? And I said, rake them into your flower beds. He said, I don't have enough flower beds. And I said, exactly. That is where you put your leaves. We're going to reduce the area of lawn. All these things work together. You're going to put big beds under your trees. That's where the leaves go. You can plant right through those leaves. You're fertilizing your trees. You're creating very viable habitat for all those caterpillars that fall out of your tree and pupate underground. And you're reducing the area that's in lawn at the same time. Trees don't want grass right up to them. They hate that. Most of our trees don't live nearly as long as they could because of the way we treat them. So we're going to reduce the lawn. We're going to put the leaves in the beds. That's what we're going to do.
Well, what are the impediments to doing this? So if listeners hear you talk and say, yeah, that sounds pretty convincing, I'd like to try that out, what are the things that can block this? I mean, one obvious one has to do with the culture of shifting one's yard to something that might look wilder, maybe more meadow-like. How does one get around the cultural obstacles, including perhaps neighbors who think that, you know, someone's place looks unkempt and abandoned?
Well, of course, you can use all non-native plants and have it unkempt and abandoned too. So I'm not promoting the lack of landscaping. You know, landscape design is important in terms of meeting the cultural norms. Remember, lawn is a status symbol. we brought Lon over to the New World to imitate the aristocracy in Europe. So Thomas Jefferson and George Washington and all of the aristocracy here used Lon, and it demonstrated that you were rich enough that you didn't have to farm every square inch you owned, and you either owned slaves or sheep that could keep that lawn in check. Then we invented the lawnmower, and everybody could have a lawn. And then the lawn care industry told us, if it's not a perfect lawn, you're a communist, or your neighbors are going to hate you. I mean, you just listen to the commercials these days. It's got to be perfect. So you've got to put all these products on it. And we've been sucked into lawn as an essential component of the suburban yard. This is why I say we're going to reduce the area of lawn, but I don't say get rid of lawn. Lawn is an essential cue for care. And the lawn we keep should still be manicured. We're not talking about not mowing it. It should be manicured. It should be mowed. We don't have to put anything on it. Mowed grass looks just fine. But it shows that you understand the culture. You're not really bucking it. You're simply going to have more plants in your yard. You're not going to have acres of lawn the way some of my neighbors have. And, you know, people, they're getting tired of hiring that lawn care company or mowing that lawn. They just feel like they have to. One of the reasons we feel we have to is that we think what was common when we were growing up is the way things always were and the way things have to be. And we all grew up with lawn. So we think, well, we've got to keep doing that. But if you think about why, there really is no good reason why we need to keep doing it. It is pretty when it's maintained, but we can have less of it. We're going to build bigger beds, so let's border those beds with mowed turf. It's the perfect plant to walk on without killing it. So it really is a cue for care. Line our driveway with it, line the sidewalk with it, and it shows that you haven't moved out, you haven't abandoned your landscaping. You are a good citizen. Your homeowners association will still love you. You're just going to have more plants in your yard.
What about light pollution, which you mentioned earlier? Living in cities, of course, light pollution is everywhere, but people do contribute individually to it as well.
Yeah, it's a major cause of insect decline, particularly the moths that make those caterpillars that run the food web. Nocturnal insects, many of them are attracted to lights. And there was just a paper the other day, still trying to figure out why that is. It's very complicated. It doesn't matter why it is. They are. They will go to your lights. And there's about 10 ways that lights kill them. They get exhausted by flying around, or they get incinerated, or they simply sit on the wall of your building, and then birds come pick them off in the morning. They're not pursuing their nocturnal activities of finding a host plant and reproducing when they're stuck at a light. So what do we do? This is where there's actually good news. It's white wavelengths, actually closer to the bluish end of the spectrum, that really attracts moths. That's why UV lights really attract moths. So if we push it to the warmer wavelengths, yellow bulbs, and some people even say use red bulbs, which would be the best, but then we would have the red light district. We'll switch your white bulbs out for yellow bulbs, and you can go to the hardware store now. They sell them. They call them bug lights. And that will be the end of your insect slaughter, because they're not attracted to it. And you can also get them in LEDs. So if we switched out our white incandescent bulbs for yellow LEDs, we'd save millions of insects and also millions of dollars. Very quickly, this is something every homeowner can do today and really turn this around.
Well, I'd like to ask you about deer. Now, kind of like light pollution, you know, if there are some things one could do individually, but these are much, much larger social problems, collective problems, political problems. I wonder if you could talk about the damage that deer do to ecosystems, and if you think there's anything that individuals can do about it.
Well, deer, it's not deer that do anything to ecosystems, it's the overabundance of deer. It's the removal of deer predators. All populations need to be controlled. And we have removed the controls of deer. And the only real predator of deer in most areas of the country now is the car, which is not a good one. The insurance agencies are not pleased with that. As a matter of fact, I think about 1,000 people a year are killed by collisions with deer and cars. So it's actually a serious health hazard as well. Deer are one of the reasons that we have a major invasive species problem, because they eat the native plants and they don't eat the non-native plants. There's a few exceptions, but they won't eat the burning bush. They don't eat the Bradford pear. They don't eat the privet. They don't eat all those things that are taking over all of our wild spaces. But if an oak tree comes up or a birch or something else, they eat that immediately. So it shifts the competitive balance against our native plants. And there's no wonder that most of the Southeast is either kudzu or bush honeysuckle. So we're talking about deer that are many times over the carrying capacity of their local environment. We have about 144 deer per square mile where I live, and it should be about 14. So if you look at the understory of our natural areas, there's no understory. You know, we've got canopy trees and nothing to the ground because they've eaten it all. So it's devastating in terms of what we call recruitment into forests. The understory of a typical forest are just young canopy trees that are waiting for a big tree to die, and then they grow up. But we don't have the young trees anymore because the deer have eaten them all. So if we persist with overpopulation of deer for a couple more decades, we're going to lose our forest. That's what it boils down to. So what do we do? You know, we also have what we call the Bambi effect. Walt Disney didn't do us a big favor back when I grew up in the 50s. We all watched Bambi, and they're cute as anything. Nobody wants to go out and shoot Bambi. But we do know how to control deer. We just have social pressure against doing that. There are some options, but putting the predators back actually works. It's not as hard as you think. I was in the Smoky Mountains, Great Smoky Mountains National Park, this past spring, and they had wonderful understory. I said, "How are you managing your deer?" And he said, "We don't manage our deer at all. But they do have black bears, they have bobcats, and they have coyotes. And that's all it takes. They don't have any wolves. Those are the major predators of deer. But let's say we're not going to put those creatures back into suburbia. What can we do?" Bern Blossy at Cornell suggests we can seriously consider market hunting. You know, market hunting is what we did at the turn of the century. It's what wiped out the bison. It's what wiped out the passenger pigeon and the Carolina parakeet and so many other things. Because people got paid to shoot these animals and then sell them for food. Under strict regulations, if we brought that back for deer, we could move deer populations back down below the carrying capacity. You could put the native plant in your yard without it being eaten immediately. Our forests would start to regenerate. Lyme disease, we didn't even talk about that. That is a creation of too many deer that has boosted the deer tick populations. So there'd be a lot of benefits to controlling the deer.
Well, short of doing those things, would you just recommend that people put, netting around their native plants to try and give them a chance, their oak trees?
Yes. Not netting. I would get wire cages. You can go to Lowe's or Home Depot, and there's this galvanized wire that's about five feet tall, and it comes in rolls. So cut out a roll and stake it with rebar around your young trees, and that'll protect it from the deer. I got a bunch of wire cages when we moved in, and it's been almost 23 years now. I am still using those cages, not on the original trees. I mean, they get to the point where they don't need any protection, and then I call that graduation, and I move the tree to, or the cage to another tree that I'm trying to support. But it's necessary. If you don't do that, I don't have the trees at all. Point is, once you make these cages, you can use them a long time, so it's not a huge investment. They're ugly. There's no doubt about it. If you're trying to do it in your front yard, it is ugly, but it's temporary. And believe me, the tree that results from that cage is going to be worth it.
What can we do to encourage the native bee population? And is it a mistake? I know various people who've decided to keep honeybees as a way of cultivating pollinators, but since they're not a native, does that cause any problems?
Yeah, this is a tough one. You know, people are trying to do the right thing. They love their bee hobby. And of course, honeybees are important pollinators of a number of our crops, which are all non-native too. But if you're raising bees for fun or honey, as a hobby, you're subsidizing a colony of thousands and thousands of bees. And those bees go out into the countryside looking for pollen and nectar. And in a typical countryside these days, we don't have nearly the amount of pollen and nectar we used to have because for other reasons, you know, all that lawn and everything else, we've gotten rid of so many of our flowering plants. So those 4,000 species of native plants, I mean, native bees, that did just about all the pollination in the entire continent before we brought honeybees over, are at a disadvantage. They have to compete with those honeybees, and there's more and more evidence that it's one of the factors contributing to native bee decline. So, you know, it's unfortunate because so many people like keeping bees, but just be aware there is a cost to our native bee populations when you do that.
You've been describing what you've been proposing, a different way of creating ecosystems in the yards we perhaps own, or the pots on our apartment window ledges, or people have farms. How does this model work in highly asphalted urban areas? Are pots of plants enough to make a difference?
Yes, they're enough to make a difference. Is it going to be as good as if you own 3 acres? No. But, you know, our migrating birds move right through cities. So if you have room for a tree, they are going to forage for caterpillars on that tree. The monarchs fly right through our cities. The native bees, there's a surprising number of native bees that are existing in our cities. And they're all looking for forage, for pollen and nectar. So I picture an apartment building with everybody's got a balcony. If you had container plants there, if that apartment building is really just a giant rock outcrop, as you see in nature, but there's little bits of plants growing throughout that rock outcrop, that's what it would be. And the wildlife in the cities would use those plants. Monarchs are extremely mobile. They will find them even if it's on the roof or 5 stories up. Our native bees are extremely mobile. So, it's not going to be a highly diverse ecosystem, but it's going to be a whole lot better than if we have no foraging plants in our cities.
As you've just said, to have any greater diversity is obviously an improvement over having none. But how much of the privately held land in this country do you think would need to turn from yards or farms to habitat to make a difference that would actually turn the tide against the ecosystem destruction that we've been witnessing now for decades or centuries?
Well, that, of course, is something nobody's measured. Again, I'll return to our property right here. We have 10 acres. That 10 acres is now, you know, it's a vibrant ecosystem. It's supporting an awful lot of life. If these are the only 10 acres in the country where life persists, it's not going to work. But I hear about people all over the country doing this. You know, we've got 770 million acres of rangeland out there. That's 4.5 times the size of Texas. We've got 410 million acres of cropland, much of which, all the roadways and the hedgerows. We could put pollinator strips through that cropland. An awful lot of that could become biologically diverse. We've got 406 million acres of private woodlots that homeowners own. And we've got 135 million acres of residential landscape that we own. So there's a lot of options out there to rebuild biodiversity. I think of this in terms of a grassroots movement to tackle the biodiversity problem. But it's something that's divided up among millions of people. Don't think about the entire planet's problems, because that gets depressing. Just worry about the piece of the earth that you can influence. If you do own property, if you do own a balcony, you can make a difference on that balcony. You can reduce the lawn or your property. You can reduce the lawn. You can fire Mosquito Joe. You can put in Keystone plants. You can put in a pollinator garden. You can modify your light system. You can get rid of your invasive plants. There's all kinds of things you can do right at home that will enhance your local ecosystem instead of continuing to degrade it. And the important thing is it shrinks that problem down to something that's manageable. Don't think about all the big problems you can't handle. Just do it at home, and then you get to see the results. And if you're done at home, then volunteer and help a land conservancy or a park or preserve, because they're all underfunded and understaffed, and they really need your help as a volunteer. So if enough of us change our adversarial relationship with nature to a collaborative one, we can turn this around. I am convinced.
What is the way for people to get a sense of other people doing something similar? Because as you were just saying, if people are working, focusing on their part, but if there's a sense that other people are doing it too, that can have a snowballing effect.
Well, this is where I'll plug our small nonprofit, Homegrown National Park, where we have what's called the biodiversity map. It's free. You simply register your property on the map and the amount of area you're going to be a good steward of, and then your little piece of your county lights up. You can see who else has joined Homegrown National Park, not in terms of name, but location, the number of people. You can watch that little number go up. We've got 37,000 people that are now members. And what we want to do is get the message that everybody is responsible for good earth stewardship. We want that message to go viral. We want to turn the entire country. We want to get entire country to light up with our little fireflies. And the reason I say everybody's responsible is because everybody requires healthy ecosystems. So it's not just ecologists and conservation biologists now. It's every single person on the planet has the responsibility of good earth stewardship.
Douglas Tallamy, thank you so much.
You are quite welcome.
Douglas Tallamy is the author of Nature's Best Hope, A New Approach to Conservation that Starts in Your Yard. We've been discussing that today. He's the co-founder of Homegrown National Park. His other books include Bringing Nature Home and The Nature of Oaks. He teaches in the Department of Entomology and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Delaware. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.